listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with me. And in the studio with you, and in studio with me, is James Gattuso, the senior research fellow with the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and a senior fellow in regulatory policy at the Heritage Foundation, and the ex-FCC deputy policy chief and regulatory staffer for the vice president of the United States when it was Dan Quayle. And James, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's, the FCC has now gotten, they closed their comment period at midnight last night, and 677,000 comments. And it seems like they're probably, we don't know for sure, but everything that we're hearing from the FCC is that they're running overwhelmingly in favor of some form of significant net neutrality. I think most people don't know the language well enough to say that they would like Title II common carrier status, but I'm guessing that most of the comments are in that vein. You would disagree with that, I'm guessing. Why?
Well, I don't know how many of the comments were for that, but I think common carrier regulation of the Internet would be a big mistake.
Why?
Well, common carrier regulation is something that was invented for taverns in the 18th century.
Well, let's make it clear for our viewers and listeners what it is we're talking about. We regulate trucking, for example. We say if you're moving somebody's furniture from one end of the country to the other, you have to treat everybody's furniture the same. You can't treat your
although actually we don't anymore. We don't regulate.
Yeah, you're right. Carter started that deregulation.
In fact, for a lot of the very same reasons.
Yeah, we regulate our highways. We regulate water. We regulate electricity. We regulate telephones under Title II.
Well, in fact, we've actually dropped a lot of forms of common carrier regulation, railroads, trucking. In particular, were dropped by Jimmy Carter because it just simply was not something that was compatible with a dynamic industry.
Right.
It's very hard to change prices, to change fares. In the airline business, we found the civilian NOx board taking a year, 2 years to change fare.
Right.
So imagine.
Well, I was in the airline. In fact, we owned a travel agency in 83 to 86, which was really when the deregulation of the travel industry was hitting, and we were watching all our competitors go down in flames, and it worked out quite well for us, that deregulation. But now the travel agency that we started just got bought by a billion-dollar company. It's like there's no more mom-and-pop shops left. That was one of the outcomes.
Very few people use a travel agent at all because they're on the Internet.
Right. So they just go to Delta's website or something.
And that would be impossible without deregulation.
Yeah.
You would not be able to go online and get the best fare you want for the route you want, for the price you want.
Right.
That would be something you'd have to go to the CAB and ask for permission to change your fare, to offer it someday in the future to public.
But if so, how do we find the middle ground here? How do you find? I think what most people want is they want to know that, for example, right now I have Comcast at home, and if I'm downloading large files, and I do download large files because I do a radio and TV show, and we move around large files a lot. Here's a clip from a video clip that we're going to use next week.
Sure.
If I start downloading large files, after about 5 minutes, they throttle me down to about 2 MIPS down, even though I'm paying for, I don't know what I'm paying for, a minimum of 10, I'm sure it's just as a consumer account. But they'll throttle me down. And so then I go in with a VPN, so I'm invisible to them. They don't know what I'm doing, and they throttle that down. And it's like, as a consumer, I have no recourse. And where I live, the only choice I have is Comcast. So this does not seem to me like an ideal situation. This is not how capitalism is supposed to work.
Well, I don't know where you live. Most people.
I live in the marina, in the public marina here in D.C., which provides internet access and TV access through a single carrier to everybody's got a boat.
Okay. I mean, most U.S. residents have access to a telephone company, internet provider line, DSL. Or a cable modem, or wireless.
Well, I have wireless down there too. We use it as a backup, and it's on Verizon's network. But I'm lucky if I can get 600K out of that.
I mean, the problem for cable companies is that their technology is more or less a shared line.
Yeah.
So if you're using a massive amount of data, you're taking that from your neighbors. So that's the reason they have to throttle you down if you're using a whole lot.
Right.
Verizon and AT&T, from what I understand, do not do that.
Uh-huh.
But it seems to me perfectly reasonable that if you are using a lot of data, a lot of bandwidth, and it's coming from your neighbors.
But I'm paying for it. My contract with them says that they would provide me with 10 MIPS. And they dial me down to two.
Well, then you have a contractual dispute. It's nothing to do with net neutrality. It's already in the law that they have to abide by their contracts.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to a question of whether there's competition. Do you have choice?
Right.
Well, isn't that the purpose of common carrier regulation, to guarantee competition?
No.
We had a lot of airlines before we deregulated the airline industry.
Actually, we didn't. We had a lot of airlines who did not compete with each other. The CAB saw it as its mission to keep them from competing with each other because they did not want them to be challenged. They did not want them to go out of business.
Well, yeah, deregulation did bring us Southwest.
Yeah. I mean, remember, the airlines were against deregulation.
Right.
Because they wanted to be protected.
Right.
Common carrier regulation, by and large, is a system where you maintain monopolies. It for industries that are monopolistic, where there's no chance for competition.
Right, and regulate them, where there's kind of a natural monopoly. But increasingly, I mean, we only have one water pipe coming into our house. It's a natural monopoly. You only have one septic system coming out of your house, natural monopoly. You only have one power line. It's a natural monopoly. Isn't the Internet increasingly becoming a natural monopoly?
I don't see it that way at all. I mean, the water line is probably the polar opposite of the Internet. The Internet is constantly changing. Water delivery is not. The Internet is diverse. Water delivery is pretty much the same thing. You get water, you don't.
Right.
There are new companies being founded all the time on the Internet. Water is water. The two cannot be more different.
But I've got one cable coming into my house. And in some places you can sign up for fiber to come into your house, and they'll put a modem in your house for the fiber, but they got to dig up your front yard, and I don't have a front yard.
In most places, they've already done that. In fact, Verizon came by our neighborhood a few years ago, dug up everyone's front yard, put in fiber that I don't think anyone in the neighborhood uses.
Huh.
But I appreciate it because it means that whenever I talk to Comcast, they know that I can always go to Verizon.
Right. But aren't duopolies... I mean, what you're saying is that if you have two or three competitors, that's as good as an infinite number of competitors. In France, what they say is that if you own the pipe, you can't discriminate against who's using it. And so, I mean, typical 100 MIP download speed Internet service in France is $22 a month. And that, by the way, includes telephone into 34 countries and 150 channels of television. So it's a pretty good deal. But what they say is, and we used to have this in Vermont when I lived in Vermont, what is now Verizon owned their copper, but a local phone company, Sovernet, they paid for use of the copper, and they provided actually our telephone service. And we got really good phone service for $25 a line.
If we only had one network in the ground, there's an argument for that. I think even then there'd be downsides.
Right.
But the fact is we have two networks in the ground in 95% of homes in America. Right. Plus miscellaneous wireless networks and new challengers. And the new challengers are sometimes big guys like Google.
Right.
It's building Google Fiber around the country. So we have competition. Now, certainly, having 100 competitors is better than having two competitors or three competitors.
Right.
But remember...
Well, if you believe that, why wouldn't the Heritage Foundation come out and say, we like the French system?
Because that's a system made for one competitor. And having the government step in, the regulators step in and say, use this part of the system and not that part of the system, you pay X amount or Y amount.
But, back in the 80s when I was running forums on CompuServe before there was an Internet, and I was one of the early Internet users, and there were thousands, literally thousands of Internet service providers that you could use. We accessed them all over our telephone via... Originally a 300 baud dial-up, then a 1200 baud dial-up. I remember when 2400 baud dial-ups came along. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
But everybody had access to the copper of my phone company. Why not do that with the Internet?
I mean, basically, those ISPs were middlemen.
Yeah.
They were connecting you to the existing network.
Right.
So, like most middlemen, if you can get rid of them, you can cut them out, buy directly from suppliers, you're better off. And the fact is, when we have two or three, like I said, you'd rather have 100... Like Coke and Pepsi compete pretty well.
Yeah.
Boeing and Airbus.
You haven't convinced me, but you make a good case. James Gattuso, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read James's work over at heritage.org. He's with a senior research fellow of the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies. We'll be back. And feel free to step across. That's no problem. Thank you, James. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And so, what do you think about the Internet? Have you contacted the FCC? Other interesting stories out there. We're going to get into Larry Pratt and the gun lobby, by the way, later on in the program. It should be entertaining. Looking at some of the Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Keep my mouth in front of my microphone. You got it, Shane. Governor Don Siegelman. I wanted to talk about this. It's been a while since we've talked to Dana Siegelman. Used to come on the program fairly regularly. I think that she's, gone off and doing other things these days. But Don Siegelman was the governor of Alabama, and he beat Bob Riley, his opponent, in the 2002 election by about 13,000 votes, and was declared the winner and went to bed the winner. And that night, in a Republican district, a Republican precinct committee chairman was locked in the room with the electronic voting machines. And the next morning, 15,000 votes had flipped from Democrat Siegelman to Republican Riley. None of those 15,000 voters voted for Republicans in other races. They all voted for Democrats in other races, but they all had voted for Bob Riley, the Republican, for governor. And the court certified that and said, okay, Bob Riley's the governor. And I'm not sure if he still is, but he was for quite a while. And Don Siegelman started yelling, hey, I've been robbed. And almost immediately, the guy who was running Bob Riley's campaign, a fellow by the name of Mr. Canary, I think it was Robert Canary, I forget his first name, his wife, Laura Canary, was the federal prosecutor, and she comes in and says, okay, we're going to put Governor Siegelman in jail. Why? Because he did the same thing two previous Republican governors had done. He appointed the same guy to the same unpaid hospital commission to oversee hospitals in the state. He appointed the same guy to the same job. But we're going to call this a bribe this time. Now, all across the country, I mean, people from like George Will, 113 former state attorneys general, Republicans and Democrats, representing 44 of the 50 states and the District of Columbia, have come out and said this was wrong. Turns out that Laura Canary's husband, Bill Canary, who ran the Riley campaign, his best friend that he grew up with in Alabama was a fellow by the name of Karl Rove. That Karl Rove nailed Don Siegelman, or Karl Rove's buddy. And Don Siegelman is, like, still in prison. And it's been a long time since 2002. It's been 12 years. He's still in prison. They, when he started yelling about, they stole the election, so they hustled this guy off to jail. Nobody could talk to him. You still can't talk to him. So, this is a big deal that everybody needs to know about, and we need to talk about more frequently. I talk about it with some regularity. I mention it, as a talk radio news sponsor. But I want to free-don.org, I believe. Yep, free-don.org is the website. And if you want to learn more about this, free-don.org, check it out. And help them out. He's an America's political prisoner. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And also, it's summer, so anything goes summer. Net neutrality proposal. I don't get why net neutrality has become a political issue. Why is it that Republicans are opposed to it and Democrats support it? Unless it has to do with it being a big business issue. In which case, maybe we should talk about it. Charles in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Charles, what's up? Charles, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about net neutrality and deregulation? Charles is not there. Let's see if Jenny's here in Plainview, New York. Jenny, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. You wanted to ask about something unrelated to net neutrality, ADD medication?
Yes. Actually, what happened is I read one of your other books, Threshold, and then the library told me that you had another book on ADD, mm-hmm. which I started reading.
Uh-huh.
And I don't read like a normal person. I kind of jump around. So I've been reading bits and pieces of the book, And it's really insightful. But one of the questions I didn't get to it in the book yet. If it's in there, it's actually the guide, the complete guide to ADHD.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I just was wondering, what is your opinion on Adderall?
Adderall?
Medication for, yes.
Yeah. First of all, the book that I've written on this topic, the two books that I've written on this topic that are the best books are The Edison Gene and ADD, A Different Perception. And so I recommend that you start out with one of those two books. That said, Adderall is a combination. It was originally sold as a diet pill back in the 60s and 70s. And it's a combination of three different amphetamines. It's got methamphetamine, which is what the guy was making in Breaking Bad, and we call crystal meth when it's sold on the streets. It's got a dextroamphetamine, which is an isomer of amphetamine, I guess. It rotates light in a particular way in the dextro, that'd be left rotation. And it's got another amphetamine in it, I'm forgetting the name of it, that and the effect of these three different amphetamines is that they all come on at different speeds, and they all decay in the body, basically, have a different half-life, disintegrate in the body at a different speed. And so the effect of it is that instead of just being effective for 3 or 4 hours like Ritalin or straight dexedrine or straight methamphetamine, they're effective for 6, 8, 10 hours or more in some people. That said, it's amphetamines, and amphetamines are, you know, popularly known as speed. For some people, Adderall helps them focus tremendously. I mean, when I was in college, I was using these exact same substances. Back in the 60s, they used to sell these things called Black Beauties, which were just diet pills, and they were, you know, Dex or meth. And we would use them to study for exams, for final exams and things. I don't think that it's such a great idea, particularly for adults. Well, also for kids, for different reasons. Kids are going through developmental phases in their brains. And when you throw chemicals in that alter brain chemistry during a developmental phase, that's a real, you know, it's a real roll of the dice. Whether that drug is alcohol, nicotine, pot, or prescription medication that, you know, is stimulants or any kind of, SSRI drugs, all of them alter brain chemistry. And when you do that during a developmental phase, the brain is highly adaptive and it tends to compensate. And then if you stop the drug, you discover that the brain has been altered in a way that, you know, it's compensating for something that's not there anymore, and it's not a good thing. So generally speaking, I'm very wary about giving these kind of drugs to kids. For adults, it becomes more problematic for adults who are over 30, because there's a fair body of evidence that indicates that when people take these stimulant drugs in particular, that they are at increased risk of microstrokes. These microstrokes are little tiny strokes in the brain that don't have the features of a regular stroke. They just, you know, little capillaries in the brain pop, and little tiny bits of the brain die off over time. And the main consequence of this, people will notice in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, is what seems to be early onset age-related dementia. They start forgetting where they left things. Their short-term memory starts to disintegrate. They can't remember names. They can't remember places. It's just, you know, and this is something that you see with alcoholics as well. So I'm pretty wary of it. On the other hand, there are some people who are so profoundly neurologically, essentially disabled as a consequence of who knows what, you know, fetal exposure to something or genetics or whatever, that they actually need drugs like this to function. So I'm not in the Scientology never ever camp, but I am in the be very, very careful, use the smallest dose possible camp. And I can't, and I'm not offering you any medical advice at all, Jenny. I please don't take this as that. But that's how I think about it. Does that make sense?
Well, this is my situation. Me and my husband don't believe in ADHD. But it's funny because when I read your book, I started understanding my son. My son is in school. He's failing math. He's failing language. Yeah. But he does brilliantly in music, and he does brilliant. Like, when he needs to concentrate, he's a genius.
Yeah. Well, Jenny, I would always try to find an environment for my kids where, the, you know, it plays to their strengths. But check out The Edison Gene. I think you'll find it a more useful book. Thank you, Jenny, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sorry to chop you off. We get these breaks. We get the tyranny of the clock here. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Tragically ugly, the good. Small business owners. According to a new poll conducted by the American Sustainable Business Council, the majority of small business owners, 61% in fact, support raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour and then increasing it every year to keep up with the cost of living. This is huge news, and it shows that the conservative talking point about so-called job creators being against raising the minimum wage is just a flat-out total lie. Small business owners, like most Americans, understand that raising the minimum wage is the right thing to do for the economy. Now, if we could only get Republicans in Congress to pay attention. The bad. Peggy Noonan, the conservative Wall Street Journal columnist, has gone full-on border crisis truther. In her Friday piece for the Murdoch-owned journal, Wall Street Journal, Noonan accused President Obama of orchestrating the surge in undocumented children crossing the border as in an attempt to force immigration reform through Congress. She said, there is every sign he let the crisis on the border build to put heat on Republicans and make them pass his idea of good immigration reform. It would be comprehensive, meaning huge, impenetrable, and probably full of mischief. I don't know what world Peggy is living in, but this just defies all logic. This border crisis has now become a huge political headache for President Obama. No rational president, and I think Obama's rational, would intentionally put themselves or their party in this situation. Only in the crazy land of the Wall Street Journal editorial page does this kind of conspiracy theory pass for commentary. And the very, very ugly Kathy Perkins, founder of the gun rights website Moms with Guns, is under fire for joking about killing President Obama on Facebook. Above a link to a Fox and Friends story about how President Obama was eating barbecue while Rick Perry was visiting the border, Perkins wrote, where is an assassin when you need one? Perkins may have just been joking, but calling for the execution of a sitting president is no laughing matter. It is very, very ugly. Amazing. Francis in Toronto, Canada, you have some insights to offer about the Canadian perspective on net neutrality?
Yeah, well, my main comment is basically to come back to your guest who called any other providers middlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I would be classified, I guess, as a middleman, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens here is if we were to just let the two big companies run the show, their greed and lack of service would affect all participants. Instead, you have small guys like myself that come in, and we don't have the same level of bureaucracy, and we don't have the same level of greed. So we actually charge lower prices than the big guys. And that actually helps people.
So you are an internet service provider. You're an ISP.
Yes, correct.
And you are not, you don't own the last mile of copper or fiber or cable to the people's homes. Do I have that correct?
That's correct.
So you go to the phone
from the big guys.
Okay, so you go to the phone company or the cable company and you rent that space on behalf of your clients and you provide them with internet over that space. So the average Canadian has access to how many different internet service providers, wherever they happen to be?
There's literally hundreds. It depends on whether they have phone line as their primary or cable as their primary.
Mm-hmm.
There tends to be more choice over DSL because the phone company is a little easier to work with.
Mm-hmm. So,
but there's literally hundreds of competitors in the market up here.
What typically does internet service cost in Canada?
I would say it probably starts in the neighborhood of about $35, and it can run well over $100, depending on the level of service.
Right. So
But we do have things like unlimited downloading as opposed to being capped all the time. And for the most part, you're not throttled unless you're leaving a peer sharing service open for 24 hours, that type of thing.
Right, right. Which I don't do. I, you know, it's that I think very few people would do
that. The problem you mentioned earlier wouldn't happen here. You wouldn't be throttled after 5 minutes unless you were on a very small, say, satellite or point-to-point type of internet service.
Right. So, wow. So how do you compete with other internet service providers, Francis? What is it that you offer? Say I'm using, you know, Acme, and you want me to use your company. How do you convince me to? Because I can buy my internet from anybody, regardless of who my phone company is or my cable company is. What makes you better than somebody else?
Well, we offer a cheap price, mm-hmm. cheaper than the big guys,
right?
Because we don't have the same level of bureaucracy or the same level of greed. Mm-hmm. We offer unlimited downloading as opposed to situating you with a cap. We have no contracts because we want people that want to be our customers, and that's why they're the customer. We don't force them to be the customer with a contract over their head.
Right.
And finally, and one of the biggest pieces, is actual customer service, where they're not just a number calling up and being ignored and being treated like a number. They're actually real people with real names.
So if I call you, I'm going to get a human being who's going to help me out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is fascinating. And so for 10 MIPS down, 1 MIP up, which is, I think, what I've got here. No? What do you think, Shane? That's pretty low. Maybe that's when we first moved to town, it was probably that. Maybe, let's say it's 25 MIPS down, 5 MIPS up. You know, what would that cost?
In the neighborhood, if it's through cable, it's about $45. If it's through the phone line, it's about $55.
Yeah, okay. I think that's in the neighborhood of what we're paying right now. So is it your sense that Canadians get a better deal than Americans, or just that they have more options to choose from?
I think the there's more choice, and the difference. See, if you were dealing with the bigger companies, those aren't the same prices. They're actually going to be a little higher than mm-hmm. the ones that I quoted through the big companies. For that same level of service, you could probably add another $10.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying is the pricing, we have such a lower population than you guys,
right,
and such a broader country to service. Our prices theoretically should be higher.
I see.
But they're not. And
because of the competition.
It would make me wonder, in the country of competition, which is the U.S., it would really make me wonder why we're paying the same.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm guessing that if we had the same internet net neutrality rules in the United States that you do in Canada, that anybody can be the grand internet service provider, and the last mile of copper has to be, you know, open to all ISPs. I'm guessing if we had those rules, our prices in this country, particularly for people in urban areas, would drop by more than half.
Oh, yeah, I think you would find a significant drop. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Francis, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you.
No problem.
And thank you for educating us all. Bob in Marseilles, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, that was interesting, the Canadian slant on that. What I wanted to bring up is that the cost for the cost and the throttling doesn't really make any difference. The important thing is the availability, Tom. And you and Amy Goodman are the two biggest examples of that. And here's the reason. I've got two people with cable running down the front of my street here. I've got the local phone company and I've got a cable company. All right?
Right.
Neither of them carry RT. Neither of them carry free speech TV. After repeated requests and offering to change my account and dump my Dish Network dish that cost me an extra $90 a month.
Yeah, well, Dish carries free speech TV.
Exactly, and that's why I've got one. But why should I have to have a Dish when I've already got my local phone company for internet?
Well, and you've also got a local radio station, which is actually how you're listening to us, right, at WCPT.
Exactly.
But I think, you know, increasingly what you'll find, it's what's one of the things that surprises me is the number of people, first of all, who listen to us all around the country and in some cases all around the world on WCPT's stream on the internet, because, you know, it comes up as one of the top searches when people are looking for our show in audio format. If you're looking for our show in video format, you know, freespeech.org, the website of the TV network is there.
Exactly. So. Well, and I could do that on my phone line because I've got fast internet access. Right. But here's the problem, Tom. I could get it cheaper if I didn't have to use my Dish Network dish to get it broadcast. There are advantages to broadcast. Yeah. Nobody knows what I see on my Dish Network dish. It's not plugged into the phone line. It's strictly one way.
Actually, it is plugged into the phone line. There's
no, it isn't. Mine is not. I've got one that's 6 years old.
Okay, so you chose not to plug it in. Okay, because most of them nowadays are, you know, they connect to the internet, and that's how, if you're going to use them for internet service, that's where your upload is over a phone line.
Right, but if you've got any interest in privacy, you don't want to plug it into your phone line,
right.
Period.
Right.
Now, here's the other thing, is whenever you stream something, not only Google knows who you're streaming, but the NSA knows who you're streaming.
Right.
The Justice Department probably knows if you're streaming porn.
Right. Whereas if you're listening to WCPT over the air, as you are, nobody knows that you're listening unless you call into a talk show and identify yourself.
Until they buy all of the broadcast media and they know exactly what you read.
Yeah, amazing. So you're... What you're raising, Bob, is the issue of privacy, which is a whole nother can of worms, a whole nother issue, but it's a good one. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And, I think over-the-air broadcasts are really important. It's one of the reasons we continue to do it. We'll be right back. Stick around. And support your local over-the-air broadcaster. That's how you're getting our show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Call them up and let them know that you're listening or watching. And if it's a commercial station, call their sponsors and thank them. If it's a non-commercial station, thank their underwriter. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Anything goes summer. Yesterday you were talking with Pat. Mr. Pat Metonio,
mm-hmm.
And Pat said, quote, Wall Street has no intent to worry about the next generation. Wall Street is all about immediate gratification and how much can I grab today, end quote.
Right, and unfortunately, which it's not just true of Wall Street. It's true of, you know, big business in America in general.
Correct, and I agree with Pat's statement, but Pat was wrong. There is one next generation that they care about, their own next generation, their own next extended family generation. Would you agree and expand on that if you see any validity to that statement?
What do you mean?
Pap said that they don't care about the next generation.
So you're saying, are you saying
they care about their own families, their own extended families. They just don't care about us, but they care about their own families and their own next generation. Agree?
Oh, yeah. If you can pull down $15-20 million a year and stash it away and try and get state taxes done away with, and I mean, this is what's happening in America, is we're becoming a nation of the haves and the have-nots, as opposed to, you know, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, we were mostly a nation of the have-somes, you know, or have-enoughs. And that's going away.
Correct.
So if that's the point that you're making, Michael, I...
Hello?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Don't know where to go beyond that with that. So thank you very much for the call, Michael. Good to hear from you. Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg, you wanted to talk about Mark Zuckerberg?
I just wanted to bring up sort of Mark Zuckerberg's donation to New York City schools. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, he donated $100 million. To Newark schools, and now reports are coming out of how that money has helped, and the result is very little. Most of that money has basically been used to funnel into other pet projects, but none of it has produced any measurable increase in any kind of student achievement, basically, or teacher achievement.
Yeah. Well, assuming that what you say is accurate, and I can't vouch for it, I didn't even know that Mark Zuckerberg had given money to a public school system. Assuming that that's the case, I thought he was one of these waiting for Superman guys who wants to give money to charter schools. But assuming that that's the case, what's your therefore out of it?
Well, I'm basically, the way I figured out a good way to kind of present what I was saying, and that's the commodity these days is delivering information. If you have a teacher,
I disagree.
You
know, I disagree. I think in schools, the commodity or the, you know, what should be measurable is delivering critical thinking skills, which is different than information. And learning skills, which is different than information.
Oh, absolutely. What I want to say is, as opposed to the non-commodity, which is individual attention, actually working with the kids to develop the skills that they individually need. You need smaller classes. You need to get to that point.
Right.
But the schools today are spending most of their time, the vast majority, on delivering information.
Teaching to the test, helping kids memorize. And I mean, with some simple little tricks, the memorization techniques, you know, like visualize absurd things, the loci method that Aristotle used to use, you visualize a house in your house in your head, and you put things in the room. And there's a whole bunch of ways to easily and quickly memorize things so that you can pass tests. That does not help. We need to teach kids how to think and how to evaluate information critically. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Tom Harmon here with you. The FCC, by the way, has apparently extended their deadline by 24 hours. I'm looking at their website, FCC.gov, and they said that, because there were some problems with the website, you can email a comment to them today. It won't be the case tomorrow. At openinternet@fcc.gov. They say, however, no, you will be filing a document into an official FCC proceeding. All information submitted, including names and addresses, will be publicly available by the web. So whatever you say to the FCC, say it. You know, keep in mind, you know, your email address will be publicized. And so, which is enough to deter me from doing it, frankly. But I think I'd rather call them. I don't know. Tina in Seal Beach, California. You wanted to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian mess?
Well, I did. I mean, I certainly agree with net neutrality, and I called my representative and the FCC and done what I could do.
Good.
I keep hearing so much about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that some people have asked me, you know, why is Hamas shooting rockets at Israeli? And, you know, I'm not even sure I know the real background and the reason. I was wondering maybe if you could just briefly go over that.
Yeah. In fact, actually, there's a I printed it out. No, I don't know what happened to it. There's a fascinating piece over at Talking Points Memo. It was a commentary by Josh Marshall. And what has happened is that the Palestinian Authority, the group that basically represents Palestinians in the West Bank, which is the part that's within contiguous Israel proper, has recognized Israel's right to exist and is willing to negotiate. Hamas, which is the democratically elected government in the Gaza Strip, and appears to be responsible, or at least this military arm of them claims responsibility for these rockets that they're firing into Israel, refuses to recognize Israel's right to exist. And this is the group that Israel asserts is funded by Iran and that Israel and the United States have listed as a terrorist organization. And so from the Israeli point of view, there's not an Israeli point of view. There's a broad number of them. Haaretz, HAARETZ.com, I believe, is the website. Haaretz is the kind of liberal, it's kind of the Guardian newspaper of Israel, and it gives you a pretty good, pretty well-rounded viewpoint of the debates that are going on among Israelis. Let me just see if I can get over to this TPM piece, because this was really thoughtful and interesting. Here it is. Inside the conflict. And keep in mind, this is an old, old conflict. But he says, I was really taken with your pair of tweets this morning about how, as David Ben-Gurion said, this isn't the one that I wanted. This is digging into deep into it. But, I don't know an answer to this. Basically, Tina, I'm sorry. The Hamas in Gaza needs to, at some point, say, okay, we're going to recognize Israel. On the other hand, Israel needs to stop running Gaza like it's a prison colony. And so in my mind, both sides are at fault here. And when you've got both sides at fault, or both sides, you know, although Israel has much, much more power than Hamas, and so that gives them, in my opinion, a larger obligation, a larger moral obligation to be the first to say, okay, we're going to clean this up, we're going to stop this. But it's a very, very difficult situation. I mean, this arguably goes back thousands of years, but in the recent history goes back to the creation of the State of Israel and the displacement of Palestinian people who were living there. And you know, to this day, those people, at least many of them in Gaza, saying, no, we want our land back. And, you know, the Palestinian Authority has said, okay, we're willing to live with you guys being here. And because the Jews were saying, you know, well, hey, we used to be there. And, you know, it's like, whose land is this to begin with? And it just it becomes one of these, you know, around in a circle. But I think the biggest issue is that if we don't clean this up, this is the conflict that is stirring up everything else in the Middle East. And this is why, you know, the last president to really do a good, serious job on this was Jimmy Carter, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize for it. And that still didn't stick. Have I added any light, Tina, to your question?
Yeah, you have. Actually, the missing piece that I had was I didn't know how Hamas connected with. I thought Hamas was representing the Palestinians, but actually,
well, they do. They do. This is the thing. Hamas was this, quote, you know, terrorist group sponsored by Iran, right? And in quotes, but then they held an election in Gaza, and the Gazans elected Hamas to represent them, while the Palestinians in the West Bank elected what used to be the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Palestinian Authority, to represent them, if I'm remembering this correctly. And so now these two groups are trying to get together.
Oh, okay.
And they're not able to get together. And Hamas is like, basically, you know, and you've got these militants within Hamas who are like, you know, these people are trying to kill us, we're going to kill them. And then you got Israelis who are saying, these guys are trying to kill us, we're going to kill them. And it's like,
right.
You know, it's a Hatfields and McCoys. You know, at some point, somebody needs to step in and say, stop. But nobody, I mean, you know, you've got Israel's now a nuclear armed power, a major superpower, and in the region anyway. And the Palestinians are, you know, sinking into poverty. And it's just a total mess. This is one of the areas where, you know, this administration has not been leading the charge in a particularly big way, which I think is unfortunate. I think that, you know, I'm with Jimmy Carter that the United States should be playing a role in that region, and not necessarily the role of, you know, putting the giant foot on the ground. I mean, this was one of the arguments that was made by the neocons in 2002 about why we needed to invade Iraq, was that it would help us occupy, you have a giant footprint right in the middle of the Arab Middle East, which would help us work out peace in Israel. That didn't work out so well either.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, over at Bloomberg View yesterday, Mark Gilbert has stirred up a firestorm of controversy with that, an article titled Euthanasia. Euthanasia is mercy killing, or, you know, killing of another person. Euthanasia is when you put down a dog or a cat, right? That's how it is typically. But putting down a person for a compassionate purpose is what euthanasia means, arguably. He says, ever watched a loved one die in a hospital bed, insensate from morphine, hands that made dinner, earned the rent, wiped away tears, and raised a child bruised and swollen after one too many stabbings to find a vein? If not, you probably will, ears straining for the final rattle in the throat and the skipped breath. And you'll probably wonder, is this the way life ends? Not with a bang, not with rage against the dying of the light, but only the prolonged agony of awaiting the inevitable? And you may also start to think maybe the folks at Dignitas in Switzerland are onto something with their assisted suicide program for the terminally ill. And maybe the UK has noticed. The House of Lords, which is the Senate of the UK, there's the House of Commons, which is the House, and the House of Lords, which is sort of their Senate, the bicameral legislature, is going to debate, quote, a bill to enable competent adults who are terminally ill to be provided at their request with specified assistance to end their own lives. He says the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland allow some form of assisted dying, as do here in the United States, Oregon, Washington, Vermont, Montana, and New Mexico. And he argues that the UK should do the same. Worldwide, 28% of the world's population now is over 55. Excuse me, over 65. 28.46% of the world's population is over 65. People who are getting into the last couple decades of their lives. And in many cases, you know, modern medicine and advances in science and all these other things have given people over 65 an opportunity to live higher quality lives than previous generations. And you know, I look back at my parents, I think ultimately the thing that killed my dad was that he smoked for 50 years But when you take that out of the equation, what you see is that people are living longer and longer and with better and better quality to their lives. So on the other hand, there are more and more, you know, the boomers are aging out and they're dying out all over the world. I mean, the baby boom was not limited to the United States after World War II. In fact, arguably, it was larger in Germany and Japan than it was here. So what do we do about this? In Switzerland, well, first of all, let me tell you about what, you know, my experience when I was living in Oregon. I was doing a morning show on KPOJ as well as this national show. And when Louise and I lived in Oregon, Washington State was going through a debate about physician-assisted suicide, essentially. Now, I remember back, you know, decades ago when it was Jack Kevorkian in Michigan, Dr. Jack Kevorkian was helping people commit suicides. And it was, you know, it was all over the press and stuff. This was in the 80s, as I recall, or maybe the 70s. And he actually went to prison for quite some time in Michigan for helping people die. And so I think that Washington State was the first state to do this. And I think it took a citizens' initiative, you know, a ballot measure, to say that if two doctors certify that you have less than 6 months to live and you are in pain, then a doctor who is licensed to do so, and you have to be licensed basically as a deaf doctor, a doctor can prescribe for you a fatal dose of a drug. I believe that they're barbiturates. It's one of the, like Seconal or whatever it is, it's one of the barbiturate drugs that you take, and it just basically slows down everything until you become unconscious, and then you just, your heart stops beating, you stop breathing, and off you go. And it takes half hour and a half after you drink this stuff to just expire gently, relatively gently. about as gently as anybody can do it. This, by the way, raises the question, if we're going to have capital punishment in this country, which I don't think we should have, but if we're going to have capital punishment in this country, why are we sticking needles in people? Why don't we just have them drink, a, you know, 6 ounces of barbiturate overdose and gently pass away? And I think the answer to that is that, you know, you've got to watch. They've got this peanut gallery that watches the execution, and people don't want to sit there for an hour and a half waiting for somebody to die, which seems bizarre to me. It's another argument against capital punishment. But back to euthanasia. When this was happening in Washington State, we had a number of people on the program, mostly religious people, saying this is wrong, this is a sin, it's against the Bible. The Bible says, or Catholic doctrine is, and much Christian doctrine is, if you commit suicide, you're not going to go to heaven, you're going to go to purgatory at the very best. And my apologies to Catholics if I'm misstating that. And then after it was passed, after this law was passed in Washington State, before it was passed, there was a woman who rather famously dehydrated herself to death. She just said, "I'm going to stop drinking." She was elderly. She was in pain. She had cancer. Her daughter was with her. The newspaper did a huge story about it. I believe it was the Oregonian. It might have been the Seattle paper. But I read it. I mean, we lived there. And this was like a big weekend feature, you know, a 3-page story and pictures and all this kind of stuff. And the reporter was there with her all the way to the end. And it takes about a week of not drinking anything for your kidneys to just shut down and you die. And she peacefully, you know, fell asleep and died. Although it, you know, there's a certain amount of discomfort associated with dying of dehydration. Which is, I think, is essentially what I saw happen with my father. He had stroked out, and after about 5 or 6 days, they were giving him no liquids, nothing. And I personally believe that he had died of dehydration at the very end. But in any case, we had, you know, after this got legalized, we had a fellow on who had been given one of these prescriptions, and his doctor, on our program. And he said, you know, having that bottle sitting on the table next to my bed, knowing that I can just reach over and pour it down my throat anytime I want, every day I wake up and I look at that bottle and I think, I can go another day. Whereas, had I not known that I could end the pain easily, I might have been frantically running around looking for a gun to shoot myself with or whatever, you know, trying to furtively, you know, and try to keep the family away. And how do you do it without making a mess? My best friend, Clark, when I was a kid, committed suicide with a gun. It makes a horrible mess. He had been drafted. He had or joined the army to avoid the draft, whatever. When I came back home from basic training over the Christmas holiday and took himself out. It's a very different thing. That's not euthanasia, that's suicide. So should we be sanctioning euthanasia in the United States? In Switzerland, there's actually this clinic, Dignitas, where people go to die. And in 5 states in the United States, doctors can prescribe overdoses. Should we do more of them?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in fact, I'd take it a step beyond that. Should our religious leaders be looking at ways to teach people how to pass appropriately? Welcome back. Michael in Dublin, Virginia, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You wanted to take on this topic?
Yes. Behind, you know, citizen, you know, we have the rights and privileges of a free man. And if we are to be so to speak, this whole idea of establishing information to people, and we speak out about it from a place that they never that that was not put there. In other words, an idea or concept is put in the minds of people who are enslaved. And when people become more aware of that idea and concept, then they rebel against it, or they speak out against it. Though it may be that that very concept and idea they're speaking out against, they're speaking for something, an idea and concept as well, that is that will establish true what it calls civil attitude and civil personality or civil character.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does that have to do with euthanasia?
Well, I think that how do you analyze how it feels when you're feeling something the way it is? How do we establish a type of analyzation or experimentation? That probably is what's been going on. An experiment on ideas and concepts of people. In a way that medicine, biological, you talked about, you said, well, we can just take a pill and drift off and go. Well, it's even deeper than that because we don't even understand how it feels. How can we analyze it?
If I can paraphrase, my understanding of what you're saying, Michael, is that we don't know what dying means or what the experience will be like. And so it's difficult for us to even discuss how we should do it and in what context. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, but we can analyze past data that's accumulated up to a certain point, maybe, that we understand the age difference between the losses due to aging.
Right.
Then we can compile data from there. But to truly define it is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
I don't disagree. I think that there is a remarkable body of literature around this in some religions, and I'm going to get into that right after the break, about death and dying and how we can use death and dying as a metaphor for living, for letting ego die, and which moves us out of the realm of death and dying into the realm of, you know, being fully alive. And this is, this is something that the Buddhists are all about, you know, is the death of the ego and then becoming one with everything and being fully awakened. And, my friend Michael Hutchison used to talk about that before he died. Michael, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes or 20 minutes past the hour. Here's a very interesting statistic. Gallup, since 1948, has been asking Americans this question. When a person has a disease that cannot be cured, do you think doctors should be allowed by law to end the patient's life by some painless means if the patient and his or her family request it? And in 1948, the number of people who said yes was 37%. It went down to 36% in 49. And then it started climbing. And in the 70s, it hit 53%, more than half of Americans. And I think it was the 70s. It could have been the 80s. The Dr. Kevorkian started getting a lot of publicity. So that by 1991, it was 65%. And by 96, which might have been the peak of Kevorkian, I frankly don't remember, it was at 75%. It has since declined somewhat. It's at 69% right now. It was 70% last year. But basically, 7 in 10 Americans support the idea of euthanasia. Let me take this a step farther. I remember I was involved with a witness to, shall we say, a training back in the 60s by a fellow who was essentially a Buddhist, He was working with the local Methodist minister, and the people going through this were also using LSD with this, which is a whole opens a whole other can of worms, and so I'd like to kind of set that to the side. But basically, what these folks were doing in the sanctuary of the Methodist Church was walking through, under acid, was walking through the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Tibetan Buddhism has a very elaborate ritual about dying associated with it. And that there are these seven bardos, these seven stages of death, some which occur before you leave the body, some which occur after you leave the body. And that so there's preparation for death, there is the experience of death, and then you are fully prepared for what's going to happen after death in the Tibetan tradition. And in some other traditions, you know, the Catholics, you're going to go to whatever, and then actually I shouldn't speak for Catholics. I'm not Catholic. I was raised Protestant, Methodist, and it was, you know, you die and you're immediately going to go to heaven. And Jesus is going to welcome you and you get to hang out on the clouds and play a harp or whatever. I mean, you know, nobody ever actually, I don't recall anybody ever actually saying this is what it's going to be like. But the Tibetans were pretty specific about it. And even the idea that you may be reincarnated and you have to go through this cycle a few times until you get it right, and then finally, you know, you become one with all and all that kind of thing. The point of all this is that there was a time back in the late 60s when death and dying was being discussed in the context of life and living. That the death of the ego, that letting go of this concept of self and becoming simply present, which is the ultimate goal of many Buddhist teachings and some Hindu teachings and the mystic Christian teachings and the mystic Muslim teachings, Islamic teachings. Look at what the Sufis say. Look at what Meister Eckhart said. Read Meister Eckhart's writings. The 16th or 17th century German Catholic mystic. Mind-boggling stuff. And it's all about letting go of ego, dying to the world, being awakened, being reborn into life. I sat with my dad for several days as he died and sat with him while he died. And I didn't realize until after he died that the kind of stroke that he had meant that he had, even though he couldn't move anything, he was probably fully conscious through that whole period of time. And one of the great regrets of my life is that I never shared with my dad while he was dying and could hear me what I had learned back when I was 16 years old, sitting through this class, essentially, in the sanctuary of the Methodist Church in East Lansing, Michigan, on Trowbridge Road, with a bunch of people who were tripping about the significance of letting go, just letting it go, and dying a good death, and not being afraid, and just being present with it. Which I hope I can bring to the forward part of my consciousness when my time comes. And if I'm not able to, I hope that there's somebody around me who can. Which raises a whole other issue, which is not just should we be giving doctors the ability to give somebody, here's 6 ounces of phenobarbital, good luck. Should our religious institutions, or maybe even something outside of our religious institutions, although this seems to me an appropriate place for religion, at least those that are less judgmental, be teaching their pastors in training, their ministers, their priests in training, their rabbis in training, their mullahs in training, whatever. Should they be teaching people how to die? Should we be talking about that in this society? I believe we should. And I think that it informs our living. I realize I'm starting to sound like I'm giving a sermon here, but you know, I feel very strongly about this, that this is one of the great lessons that I learned from Michael Hutchison, who passed away just this last year, but who has been a guest on this program a number of times back 5-6 years ago when he was able to do so, and who had this experience of being paralyzed from the neck down and letting go. And experiencing this massive enlightenment where just everything in the universe became him and he became it, and it was just, it's all one. And I would call him up and we'd have these long conversations, and he'd say, you're just watching the movie, Tom. Stop thinking it's real. It's just the movie. You are everything. You're not just this little person. And it's all playing out exactly the way it's supposed to. When it hurts, that's how it's supposed to play out. When it feels good, that's how it's supposed to play out. If you take any of it seriously and think that it's that there's really a you who's here, then you just get stuck in it. It was amazing, this conversation, Michael Minister. Shouldn't we be having these kind of conversations with dying people?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Shouldn't we look at a body of literature about God? I mean, it exists. It's there. In fact, look at it as a great starting point. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
By the way, good sermon earlier.
Thank you. So, apropos of the topic, you wanted to speak to it.
I'm sorry?
You wanted to speak to that topic. To the topic.
Give me one sec here. I'm near a truck here. Just let me blow past this guy.
Okay.
Now, I wanted to weigh in on and draw a parallel between abortion and euthanasia, and how, you know, being a believer, a Christian, I look at abortion a certain way because when I was younger, I partook in the act, and, I understand. I wouldn't condemn anyone, but I perceive it differently. If we can save a life, we can save a life. But in looking at that, we're talking about, isn't this convenience in the end? So if we have the right to extinguish a life invariably in some, along that trimester scale, let's say, and compare that to someone just like as a baby, we turn the same when we get older. Isn't there a comparable scale where we could, the law is equitable on both sides, that maybe the law's in place already to support euthanasia?
I think that there should be, Jay, and I think that there is, actually. I know, there was a hospice nurse with our family when my dad died, and she basically said, shall I give him more morphine? And I didn't realize at the time she was saying, shall I put him out of his misery? But essentially she was, and my brother and I said, yes, he looks like he's in pain, and she did, and he stopped breathing. And I think that there should be and I think that there is for most people in most families, a fairly sober, thoughtful discussion. And, I've known people who've had abortions and who say, this is not something that you take lightly. You don't go in and say, hey, it's Sunday, I think I'll have an abortion. And similarly around dying. So I don't altogether disagree with you. I'm not someone who thinks that, 16 cells that are rapidly reproducing in somebody's fallopian tubes or in somebody's uterus are a human being yet. But and so I think that there are lines to be drawn in there somewhere, and I don't think that making an absolute comparison between abortion, or early term abortion anyway, and euthanasia is appropriate. But I do think that sobriety, thoughtfulness, we've had these conversations around beginning of life issues for a long, long time. We haven't had them around end of life issues. It's time to do that. Dylan in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Hey, Dylan.
Hey, on the issue of euthanasia, I was not raised religious, but purely from a government perspective, I think that the basic right that a government should provide to its people is the right to yourself, because we should all own ourselves, mm-hmm. in a sense. So, especially for someone, for an elderly person, or person with a terminal illness.
Right. So if we own ourselves, we should be able to extinguish ourselves. Now, here's where it gets complicated. This clinic in Switzerland has where you can go, this Dignitas, where you can go to commit suicide. A couple by the name of Robert and Jennifer Stokes from Great Britain went there. This was back in 2004. They had met at a psychiatric hospital in the 70s. Jennifer had tried to commit suicide a number of times. Robert was paranoid. They were both mentally ill. They married. They tried to commit suicide together a couple of times. Finally, they went to this clinic, and the clinic helped them commit suicide together. They had convinced the doctors at the clinic that they both had terminal illness diagnoses, which is what the clinic thought. They thought that they were both dying of terminal cancers. In fact, neither one of them had terminal illnesses. But on the other hand, you know, they were in their 60s. You could say everybody has a terminal illness. You know, it's called life. You know, we're all going to die someday. And you could say that, you know, clearly they thought that they were in enough pain out of their paranoia, out of their mental illness, that they wanted to end it. Where do we start drawing these lines at law?
Well, I think with the case of people who are, like, people who are depressed and, like, people with some psychological issues, there should be some, like, obvious, I don't think anyone should be able to walk into a hospital and say, I want to die. Like, I think there should be some psychological evaluations that, like, that people can need to go through. Like, are you actually ill? Do you
right? We need to filter out people who are suicidal because of an organic illness like postpartum depression or whatever that can be treated with medication or therapy.
Right.
Okay. I would agree with that.
A psychologist should be able to determine if you're actually severely depressed.
But now we're creating gatekeepers for death. And, you know, a lot of people, like my friend Clark, I suspect had Clark lived, he would have looked back. I think if he was my age right now, I mean, he died when he was 19, when we were both 19. I think he would have looked back and said, boy, that was really dumb. I think that a lot of teenagers think about suicide at times, and a lot of teenagers try suicide, and it's more of a, not a real, genuine attempt. It's more of a cry for attention kind of thing. And, you know, I've certainly known my share of them over the years who have done that. And I think that those, you know, we don't want to make it any easier for that kind of thing to happen. On the other hand, we don't want to, I don't think we should be making it harder for people who are genuinely dying to die easily and with grace and comfort. Does that make sense, Dylan?
Yeah, that makes
sense. Okay.
I was
right.
Trying to think of it like from a libertarian perspective, to which you should have the right, but there should be stipulations to prevent you from getting to that point.
And I think this is one of those 27 topics that Ralph Nader just wrote a book about, where libertarians and progressives probably completely agree, and the middle ground gets very confused. Dylan, thank you for the call. Terrell in Denver, Colorado, you wanted to weigh in on this issue.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I think first we should concentrate on the preconditions of this rather than the end result. I think it's a better argument to concentrate on that level.
Meaning we should determine who is sufficiently sick that they qualify for this? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, who is eligible.
Right. Well, the eligibility in the states that have adopted the right to die is what they refer to it as. The states that have done this, I lived in one of them, Oregon, and I watched the process in Washington State when they went through that. Basically, what they've come to, and I believe that my memory is correct on this, is that you have to have two doctors say that you have less than 6 months to live and certify that you have there will be a reasonable assumption of unbearable pain, and that if those criteria are met, then you can be prescribed a drug that will help you stop the pain and stop your life.
Okay, but what was the advertising like on TV for or against that?
Well, this gets into the area where, you mean when the campaigns were happening?
Yes.
Yeah. Most of the ads that were vote no on this proposition were sponsored by religious organizations, particularly the Catholics, who were saying, suicide is viewed by God as murder. It's murder of self, but it's still murder, and it's a mortal sin. And we as a society do not want to be participating in sin. This is the same argument that you make against the death penalty, by the way. And
well, I mean, that's back to the Hobby Lobby thing. We think this, therefore it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares what God thinks? We have a liberal actual thing of what truth is, and if they could just say whatever they want to fit there, it's...
Well, that's the problem. I mean, it's the question that has been asked by Jesus and many others, you know, what is truth? You know, I think Jesus asked Peter that, in fact, rhetorically. Terrell, yeah, good point. The focus on the preconditions. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, you wanted to weigh in on euthanasia?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just lost a brother recently on July 2nd, so...
I'm sorry for your loss,
tough,
Jesse.
But the way you talk about the end of life, the way the Buddhist monks say, let yourself go, I think that should be true politically, economically, and spiritually, religiously. So to know how to die, you have to know how to live. How do we get to that point where we say, you know, what's the line of saying, you know, how do we let go of life depending on how we live spiritually, economically, politically? Looking at the history of humanity, we used to believe in animals setting our religion. Now we up to the point of our physical well-being setting our ideas. Where do you come on this? I think I know, but thanks and wait to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Thanks, Jesse, for your comments. And how do we deal with people with mental illness in this equation? This is where I think that, number one, we need to have a national conversation about this. I keep saying we need to have a national conversation about abortion. We also, you know, when does life begin? We also need to have a national conversation about when does life end. And not just because most people's medical bills, you know, 80, 90% of the entire medical bills for their entire lives are in the last 6 months of their life, and that's stupid. Or at least it's not necessary, it's not productive. And in many cases, it's prolonged torture by law. But also because I think that we, by learning how to die appropriately, we can learn how to live appropriately. And we can be more fearless in our life if we're less fearful of death. It's a topic we're not afraid to talk about. In my humble opinion.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it's like parents sit down and talk with their kids about sex. We all have talked about having that conversation. How about talking about death and suicide? I mean, this is a topic parents are absolutely terrified to bring up with their children for fear that their children are thinking about it. And yet somebody should say, you know, probably you're going to know a friend who's going to try and commit suicide. And you need to know that this can be a sign of a mental illness. This could be a cry for help. This isn't, you know, it's, and here's how you can intervene even. You know, here's suicide hotlines. You know, those kind of things. Anyhow, Lily in Hartford, Wisconsin. Hey, Lily. Thanks for...
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was listening to your show, and I realized that you were talking about euthanasia. I don't know if anybody had mentioned it. I just lost my mother last month when she was in hospice at home with mm-hmm. me. And, you know, watching her die slowly was absolutely horrible, as you probably know from your dad. Yeah. But I said, we're kinder to our pets than we are to people. It's like, if I could get this drug for myself, if I know I'm going to die, I'm going to move to Oregon or Washington. You know, this is just horrible,
right,
to watch someone go through this.
Right. Well, and the interesting thing is when they looked at the statistics, what they found was that the percentage of people who committed suicide actually went down. That having that drug next to you on the table, next to the bed, actually caused people to postpone the decision to commit suicide until they naturally died. And in
right.
more cases than the other way around. So, excellent point, Lily. Thank you for calling and making it. Corky in Hilton, New York, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Oh, Tom, yeah, you can't know anybody's pain level. You can't know anybody's suffering unless you're inside them feeling it yourself.
You're right.
And I always believe that you can't leave the restaurant until the bill is paid. You have to pay the bill before you can go. So if suffering's the monetary payment for living life, then you're going to suffer until you've paid all the wrongs you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, There's nothing to do with
it. You think it all balances out in one individual life? I mean, you look at somebody like Adolf Hitler and say, how could that be?
Well, you know, I equate this to, I've talked to your screener, I equate this to the children at the border. Nobody knows what those kids have gone through until they go through it themselves.
Yeah.
They're standing there yelling, go home, go home. These kids, we don't know what kind of life they had back there, what kind of fear they were living.
Well, our media is doing a very, very poor job of informing us about that, and I was very, very pleased to see Telemundo start talking.
You can't know what somebody's suffering and what they're going through until you went through it yourself. But you can have compassion and understanding and try to understand.
Right.
But the way my dad taught me was, you better be kind to everybody you meet in this world because you're going to pay for it at the end. Yeah. If you want a nice, easy, soft death, then you treat everybody good and don't cheat them.
Oh, that's
if you don't care about that and you're prepared to suffer, then screw everybody and live the way you want.
See, I think that's a metaphor for the way we live our lives, too. I think that the people who are constantly trying to screw other people are people who are themselves in pain constantly. And it's a self-inflicted pain. But, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe not. Corky, thanks for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a freed slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org, America's last political prisoner. And Ellen Ratner, whose office is right down the hall, and today is in the studio with us.
Well,
it's so
I am
nice
in
to
the
see
studio.
You.
Yes, that's a rarity, but I'm here. So the Congressional Budget Office today just reported their economic report. They say the debt is going to be 106% of the GDP by the year 2039 at this rate. They said it is 74% of the GDP this year, our debt. But they said it is not due to greater debt. It is due, actually, to the slowing of the economy. Hmm. Now, that is interesting because also today, one of the things that's happening is that there is going to be this vote on the transportation bill.
Right, which would speed up the economy.
Which it absolutely would. The AFL-CIO came out with some statistics today in terms of supporting the Highway Trust Fund. The Republicans are asking, and the Democrats, I guess they're sort of agreeing on a $10.8 billion plan. But what's interesting about this $10.8 billion plan are some of the Club for Growth and some of the real right-wingers are objecting to even spending that. AFL-CIO said 35,000 jobs would be created for every $1 billion spent. So, I mean, you're talking about 350,000 jobs. That's a lot of jobs created in the economy if there's $10.8 billion.
Right.
And what
if we spent $100 billion? You know,
I mean, $10 billion is a drop in the bucket. You and I know that. They said 25% of the bridges in the United States are structurally unsound and that the United States' roads are actually 17th in the world.
Wow.
I know. Pretty astounding. So the president today actually gave a little bit of a talk about this today, and he was in Virginia. He talked about taking actions to for the American people. He said, while the Congress's big idea is suing him, and he said he's waiting for Congress to act, but in the meantime, I've got to go ahead and do what I can do. And he said he encourages Congress, of course, to pass the Highway Trust Fund. But again, it's only $10.8 billion.
Right.
There needs to be a lot more. Okay.
This is, by the way, my theory of the Republican strategy is keep the economy slow, keep things going badly as long as
until they get in.
Us. Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, it's going to percolate around.
Yeah, they'll start spending like drunken sailors, just like they did during the Reagan and the Bush administrations.
Right, so. Exactly. But, of course, the Democrats are spending. Okay, so Steny Hoyer also talked about the border crisis today. He had a pen and pad.
He's the number two Democrat in the House.
Right? That's right. Leader Hoyer, House Minority Whip, he said that the 4.3 supplemental is absolutely necessary. The Republicans are saying no. He said it will provide for additional detainment capacity, will also provide for increased stability to go after traffickers. You know, it was funny. I was just at your favorite place, Fox, and I was talking to one of the reporters there, and we were talking about the fact that if they don't do something about the drug crisis in this country, the heroin coming into this country, that's what these gangs are, and that's why people are being driven out. These kids are being driven out. It's not safe.
And you know what's driving that is the opium production in Afghanistan. They're producing 600-700 million pounds a year.
Than they ever more produced.
Yeah. And you know, the first year of the Bush administration, George Bush gave Mullah Omar $20 or $30 million and said, here, burn the poppy crops. And there was such a steep fall off in opium production that year that the worldwide price of heroin went up. The number of heroin addicts went down. HIV infections went down. Addictions went down. And then, you know, then we started bombing them and all that.
Well, and now they feel that it's a cash crop to support whatever craziness they do, and then it comes through South America and Central America, and look what happens.
Yep. And the United States, too. We've got a big heroin problem here.
Well, we have a heroin problem, but that's how it gets to us.
Yeah.
I mean, on these craziness. Okay. More news, and this is kind of interesting. Last night there was a long hearing, I think it went on for 5 hours, about the Veterans Administration. They tend to have these at night, I think, probably so that people in California, A, can get to them, and, two, they can show them in California.
Was this in the House?
This was in the House, okay. House Committee on Veterans Affairs. So they did, their staff had an unannounced visit to the VA in Philadelphia. Guess what? The VA people said to them, well, let's go. You have to go into this room, and this is where you can meet. And they had cameras and hidden microphones, and they taped the congressional staff. Now, I'm telling you, that is really unheard of. And so you just wonder, what is going on with the VA? It gets worse and worse and worse.
Well, was it let's be sneaky and tape the staff, or do they just have security cameras in every room because you've had people shoot up VAs?
No, I think it was let's be sneaky and,
really?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think this was kind of bipartisan. They were not very happy campers.
Yeah.
Congress was not happy at all. Also on the economy, Janet Yellen testified today. This is her quarterly testimony. She testified both for House Banking and
she's
Housing.
She's chairwoman of the Fed.
She's chairwoman of the Fed. She said the economy, there has been progress in the economy, but she said, and this is one of the reasons that a lot of us supported her for that, is she's very concerned about unemployment still. She said it's way too high. She said that inflation remains very low beyond their long-term objective, but they feel that they have the right to raise interest rates. And, of course, it's basically zero for the banks, or as you would call them, banksters, which I always – Dr. Tom and his banksters. I think you ought to write a book called Dr. Tom and his banksters.
Okay, you got it.
So that is that's really sort of top of the hit parade on her financial situation. Also today, John McCain went after the nominee for the ambassador to Turkey, saying that he was not being direct enough about Turkey's lack of transparency, and of course going after the various press, Twitter accounts, etc. So he was rather upset about that. And Secretary Kerry was in Vienna today. He said that there has been progress on the Iran nuclear agreement, and in terms of Hamas and Israel, he did say Israel has a right to defend itself, went after Hamas for lobbing missiles in, and so he was pretty active on that. Also, the CDC issued a new state of physical activity. Some states just don't make it.
Wow. We need JFK King.
We do.
Then Michelle Obama's trying to do it. Ellen Rantner with the Talk Radio News Service.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Alexander Zaitchuk on the line with us. He's a freelance journalist and contributor to Rolling Stone magazines and also Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org. He's a fellow with the American Independent Institute, TAII, but the main website, MediaMatters.org and RollingStone.com. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Larry Pratt has been a guest on this program a number of times over the last 8 or 10 years. Gun Owners of America presents him as, you know, hey, here's a voice about, you know, an alternative to the NRA. You don't want to talk to the average NRA guy, talk to Gun Owners of America. You have looked into Larry and come up with something a little strange. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to Mr. Pratt than meets the surface. I'm not sure what he said in your various interviews with him, but he speaks to a lot of different audiences, and over the years, those audiences have included some very scary people, ranging from straight-up neo-Nazis to Christian Identity church activists to Ku Klux Klan members.
Well, these are the kind of people that I actually like to put on the air, because it exposes them for what they are.
Right.
But I understand that Larry has been on CNN and MSNBC, or I don't know about MSNBC, but he's been on the big networks and the big cable systems regularly and frequently. And you're suggesting I mean, every time Larry comes on this program, he and I have a knockdown, drag-out fight.
Right.
And when he goes on those programs, I'm guessing that's not how it plays out.
Yeah, he has a very sort of grandfatherly demeanor on these shows, and he edges his language and his ideas in a way maybe he doesn't with you, and he can often sound very, hardline, but also very measured and not very scary. But if you go back through his history, you realize that there's some past there that really should be dredged up in any sort of honest introduction of the guy. And you never see that when he's discussed with respect or even reverence in places like the New York Times or on one of his multiple appearances on a place like CNN, as you mentioned.
Right. So why is that?
Well, I think a lot of it is just people don't know. I mean, our memory is constantly being shortened, and the last time anyone really looked at this guy in some of these sundry connections was mid-90s, and that was, you know, 20 years ago. So I think the purpose of this piece I just did was to sort of remind bookers and producers that, you know, that there's more here that should be discussed, and he has a role in the larger gun movement that should warrant some attention. He's not just pulling the NRA to the right, although that's how he sees his main task. He's also a conduit for the mainline gun lobby and gun rights movement and some of these scarier organizations that are more explicitly okay with violence against the state.
Isn't this meta to a problem in our media that's much larger than this? I remember, I think it was Media Matters did it. It may have been at a different group. It might have been Robert Greenwald. Back in around 2004, 2003, 2004, they started looking at all of these generals who were coming on all the various networks, and particularly the cable networks, to do, you know, blow-by-blow narrative of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and talk about weapon systems and here's how this works, and when you see this bomb going down this chimney, this is a smart bomb. And turns out that the vast majority of these guys had, in some cases, multi-million-dollar contracts with the defense contractors who were making this stuff, and they were coming on basically doing infomercials for the products rather than any kind of critical analysis of the war or the rationale for the war. It was all cheerleading. And is this not sort of in that same category? They were never identified as
yeah,
front men.
I think that's a fair thing to evoke in thinking about Larry Pratt and his role in the media. Although with regard to the generals, whether that was lack of due diligence or tolerance for corruption or both, I'm not sure. In this case, it's probably almost certainly just a case of lack of due diligence. I think if most of the people giving him a microphone knew what he was really about and what he really believed about the U.S. Constitution and the Second Amendment and the role of the Bible in public life, they probably would not be giving him so much airtime.
Now, that said, I mean, I had Sheriff Mack on the show the other day. We were talking about, you know, this whole movement that he's part of that says that, you know, the county sheriff should be the senior law of the land, you know, and we shouldn't be recognizing the FBI and all this. And I'm like, I think this is whack job stuff. But there's a startling number of people out there, and Clive and Bundy has really, held this up to the light, or the story of Clive and Bundy, I think, has held this up to the light. There's a surprising number of people out there who, and a growing number, which is the startling thing, who agree with these perspectives that Clive and Bundy and Larry Pratt and I mean, he goes back to the Reagan era when they were arming the death squads down in Central America, according to your article. Saying, oh yeah, good work. And these are the people who are now, or their children, you know, the next generation of the same people who are now, you know, murdering these children who are fleeing Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras and showing up on our southern border.
Yeah, that's an interesting full circle there. You're right. Yeah, in the 80s, Pratt was making regular trips down to Central America as a representative of the foreign policy establishment in Washington, and sort of skirting the line again, as he's done in many areas between the legal and the extra-legal. He was observing in a semi-official capacity the death squads or civil defense patrols, as they were known, of Rios Montt, the military dictator of Guatemala in the early 80s. And then he came back and wrote a book about how these death squads basically were a model for not only persecuting the drug war in the U.S., but also keeping the American government honest, because if there were enough armed groups out there, that they would feel that they, you know,
we should create our own death squads.
Yeah, yeah.
Which arguably is what Tim McVeigh did, and Larry apparently had something to say about that.
Yeah, after the Oklahoma City bombing, Pratt was the day of the bombing. He was actually protesting the FBI building in Washington, which is interesting in itself. But shortly after the bombing,
Well, that was the second anniversary of Waco, wasn't it?
Correct. Yeah. Which he was also...
And also, like, something that was tied close... It was close to Hitler's birthday, too, wasn't it? Or the day that he died?
Yeah, there's a lot of symbolic dates around that period that are interesting.
Pardon my interrupting you.
Pratt has insinuated that Tim McVeigh was, in fact, doing God's work, and he was not willing to wait for, mortal justice. And he had to take it to... take the, you know, divine retribution into his own hands and all sorts of stuff that, again, he wouldn't say on CNN, but he said to smaller, more private audiences over the years, and that's really how he sees the world.
Wow. Now, what about, I mean, this is one guy. Did you see the op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, the day before, about Stormfront.org, about this website? And how they've been growing.
I'm quite familiar with the website. I didn't see that.
Yeah, but it was basically an article about the growth of the neo-Nazi movement and how there's so many people involved with this that you would think of as just, you know, the ordinary guy or girl next door.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of them have day jobs and keep their tattoos covered up. And
a lot of them don't even have tattoos. They're just, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So what do we do as a society? We just expose it?
Well, I mean, luckily, that's a movement that I don't think, according to the data that I've seen, is particularly on the upswing. But, keeping law enforcement abreast of the size and movement of those groups is important. And groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center do yeoman's work on that front, sending out the intelligence report and their various publications to local police forces. But, just keep the maps current is the main thing.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's just how all this is happening, and how I personally think that a lot of this is a response to you know, bad economic times, and the bad economic times have been brought about by its own fraud and theft and political
misconduct. Yeah, absolutely. Misconduct. Yeah, you can't lose that big picture in the background.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There you go. Alexander Zaitchuk, am I saying that right, Alexander?
Yep, Zaitchuk.
Zaitchuk. You can read his article over at rollingstone.com and at mediamatters.org. Alexander, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer here right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jerry, listening on WBAI in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss the problem of so many corporate people being appointed to government positions of power. And I have the latest example, but first let me preface my remarks by pointing out that what I'm going to talk about comes against the backdrop of legislation to have the government pay for veterans who have to wait longer than 30 days to see a VA doctor, to have these veterans instead see a private doctors and private hospitals outside the VA system. Because let me sarcastically say that we all know, Tom, that no one has to wait long periods of time or travel long distances to see a doctor in the private sector system of health care. But anyway, against this backdrop, I find it very troubling, and this is what I want to talk about. Against this backdrop, I find it very troubling that now we have President Obama appointing a former CEO from corporate America, in this case from the Procter & Gamble Corporation, to be the new head of the VA. And what's so troubling about this is part of a pattern I see, especially in President Obama's second term, of him appointing more and more former corporate people to his administration with very little backlash from liberal Democrats. We see this happening from the former GE executive who he appointed to head up his team of economic advisors, to the men he chose to head up both the FCC and a major division of the FDA. With respect to the FCC, we all know we have this Wheeler guy who is literally a former cable company lobbyist. And then with respect to the FDA, we have this Taylor guy who is extensively involved in the food industry. Now he's heading up a major division of the FDA related to food safety, as I understand it. And we even have Eric Holder. Many people forget that Eric Holder, in addition to being with the Clinton Justice Department, after he left the Clinton Justice Department, Mike Papatoni was pointed out on numerous occasions, I don't know if he did, I forget whether he did yesterday or not, but on numerous occasions, Mike Papatoni has pointed out how Eric Holder, after he left the Clinton Justice Department, became a corporate attorney. And the result of having someone like Eric Holder in charge of the Justice Department is that just as we've had banks considered too big to fail, now we have banksters considered too big to jail. And we see evidence of this yesterday, and the deal worked out yesterday. Once again, Citibank or Citigroup, which owns Citibank, instead of anyone going to jail, is simply going to be fined, which they can write off as the cost of doing business. And this is why I have to disagree with something you said yesterday, that it does not matter which Democrat becomes president. I think it's extremely important, because if we have a corporate Wall Street Democrat in the White House in 2016, we're going to see more of this sort of thing, with more corporate people being appointed to positions of power. And when wrongdoing goes on in Wall Street or elsewhere in the corporate world, it just won't be punished.
I think there are two dimensions to this, Jerry. I think that the people in office respond to the loudest voices. When Obama was doing local politics in Illinois, and when he was doing statewide politics as a state senator, the loudest voices were the progressives on the ground who were working on his campaigns. And he was responding to them. He was talking about national health care. He was talking about single payer health care. He was talking about breaking up big corporations, about being a trust buster, all these kind of things. Then he gets into national politics, becomes a senator, and then becomes president. And at that level, Citizens United kicks in, and the loudest voices are the billionaires and the corporations. And he's responding to them. I don't say that in defense of him. I say that by way of saying, A, we need to become the loudest voices, like we were back in 1933 when FDR was sworn into office. And number two, we need to stop these Supreme Court decisions that allow billionaires to be the loudest voices. Jerry, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I found that piece by Josh Marshall that I mentioned in the first hour that I just want to close this, you know, wrap up this topic about what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now. The Palestinian envoy, Josh Marshall, writes over at Talking Points Memo, CNN.com. The Palestinian envoy of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva tells Palestinian Authority TV that the Palestinian Authority needs to be prudent about appeals to the Human Rights Council because every Hamas rocket fired indiscriminately without warning into civilian areas constitutes, quote, a crime against humanity. So this is the conflict between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, Hamas controlling Gaza, the Palestinian Authority controlling the West Bank. He also notes reports from Gaza about how the IDF, this is the Israeli army, the Israeli Defense Force, is sending advance evacuation warnings before the bombing attacks, the so-called knock on the door or the roof. This candor will and is, Josh Marshall notes, being seized on by the supporters of Israel, but it's just as much a rebuke to the rejectionist right in Israel who claim there's no partner for peace among the Palestinians. In other words, here you've got the Palestinian Authority being your partner for peace, Israel. Pay attention. And Josh says there's a path to an end of all this. Not just this flare-up, but the whole conflict. It's there. It just needs to be taken. And that was the point that I was trying to make in the first segment. The problem is that Hamas seems to have no interest in participating in that. On the other hand, you know, they've been through hell and back. So it's like we're back to the beginning. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. You wanted to talk about abortion?
Yeah. The fellow that came on and said that abortion was a quote-unquote convenience. My wife used to volunteer for Planned Parenthood, and some of the stuff that she and I was kind of, before I met her, I was kind of oblivious to it, you know, being a man, having that sort of anatomy. But it has got to be, if not the most, one of the most heart-wrenching decisions a woman would ever make. And it just really irks me how the right, especially those on the religious right, couch it in terms of deciding where to go, where to eat, or what to wear.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It has never been my experience that any woman considering abortion is doing so frivolously. And I think that the by and large men on the right who characterize women as behaving that way, this is part of a misogynistic worldview that considers women to be, that infantilizes women, basically, that deals with them as if they are children. And it is a reflection of a patriarchal worldview that is not only out of date, but is actively destructive to our society. Hack, thanks for your comments. Well said. Paul in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Paul, what's up? Paul, you want to talk about stem cells? Paul is not there. Michael in Denver, Colorado. You wanted to talk about net neutrality, Michael?
Tom, with your permission, that was way back and I had some ideas and whatnot and a question for you, but you got on to euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
And
just
very briefly here, 1968, my grandfather passed away. Mm-hmm. And the way he passed away is that he stopped everything. Including the acceptance of last rites and all. He wasn't a very religious man. And what irked me about my grandmother was that after, right when he was pronounced dead, she asked the priest if he could do the extreme unction, which Catholics do. And he did it, saying that the spirit might not have left the body completely yet. Hmm. So in order, you know, for him to do it,
So we'll give him a kick into heaven,
almost, so to speak, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Mike, you know, in essence, it is really, in terms of the way I see humanity and how he taught me, it is really our right and our responsibility with our families, in particular our loved ones, to say to whatever entity there is out there, church, government, whatever. If our family member is suffering with pain and dying and, you know, terrible disease, then we're going to let them go. And the best way to do that is at home, like my grandfather did back in 1968. We were the hospice.
Right.
And
he just stopped eating and drinking?
He just basically stopped. He was still boxing at the age of 80.
If I told you the history, you wouldn't believe me. You would not believe me. He was a man of very little formal education, but he traveled the world. He probably went around the world a half a dozen times. He was a merchant marine. Mm-hmm. He was in the Liberty fleets. He got torpedoed.
Wow.
And he survived, and he literally raised me and gave me a lot of his honesty and his forthrightness and all. So, not to get any commentary or anything, but I just wanted to say along those lines that in terms of myself and our family here, we will not accept and we will not tolerate any interference in a decision like that. Same thing in terms of if anyone, a younger female in our family was to need abortion, we'll escort her to the facility so she gets a hygienic and safe abortion if that is the decision that needs to be made. And I believe that that is strictly base level, a human decision that's made by those people that have the same blood running through you.
Yeah, that we should have. I mean, this is one of Ralph Nader's 27 issues where liberals and Tea Partiers, conservatives, libertarians,
yes,
probably agree, and in fact emphatically agree that our right to our bodies is absolute. That the state has no demonstrable business in inserting itself in these very, very personal decisions of life and death, that, you know, at beginning and end of life, or, you know, pre-beginning of life, and at the end of life. Michael, thank you. Very, very eloquent for your commentary, and I'm grateful that you could share with your grandfather with us and that you had him when you were young. That's a remarkable story. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your thoughts and my thoughts on the news of the day. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Back to my call screen software here. Paul in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A little bit different topic, but you certainly had some good ones this afternoon, and let's go positive for the net freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But I had something interesting I thought you would be interested in. I just was able to have a stem cell treatment for some vision issues that I've had basically all my life, and this is using your own stem cells from bone marrow. There's a NIH and National Eye Institute certified clinical trial by a doctor in Florida outside of Fort Lauderdale that takes the stem cells out of the bone marrow and injects them in the affected eye. Oh. And they started the clinical trial back in October last year, and it'll probably go through next year. And they're going to do up to 300 people. I've been in contact with several other people that have had it, and it was just 3 months ago, and I've already had measurable improvement.
Wow.
Advantage is, of course, that since it's your own stem cells, there's no rejection, and there's no issue about embryonic stem cells by, you know, people that object to that.
Right. Stem cells are cells that have the potential to become any cell in the body.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, I'd had vision issues my whole life, and congenital cataracts and that kind of thing, glaucoma. And about the mid-90s, I never had really good vision, but it even started to get worse. And then we decided to try this, and it's not cheap. There's no it's not being funded by a drug company because there's no drug involved or a device.
Right.
It's overall a very simple thing. You're taking cells, extracting them from the marrow, and then injecting them. So I mean, it's so simple but so complex all at the same time. But they're trying it on people with any kind of retinal or optic nerve, almost any kind of optic nerve and retinal issue.
Yeah,
people with glaucoma, macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, all this.
Sounds like the future of medicine. Paul, there was a fascinating study that and an interesting analysis that this brings to mind some years ago. This was almost a decade ago. As I recall, I think this was the Red Cross who sponsored this longitudinal study of the health of people who were regular blood donors. And what they found was that men who donated, that first of all, that menstruating women had about a quarter, a 25% lower rate of death from a whole variety of things, heart attack, stroke, cancer, I mean, you name it, everything except car accidents, had about a 25% lower rate of death than did non-menstruating women or men, and which caused them to scratch their heads a little bit. So then they looked at the epidemiology, the numbers on men who gave blood twice a year or more, which would be about the equivalent of a year's worth of menstrual cycles. And those men who gave blood twice a year or more had that same 25% decrease in death rates from all causes. And they had no answer for this, you know, why this is, other than that it was possible, and this was the speculation, and like I said, this was a decade or more ago, back when they were first figuring out what stem cells were, it was possible that a loss of blood, like a woman experiences when she menstruates or a man experiences when he gives blood, causes the bone marrow to go into hyperdrive because the blood cells are made in the bone marrow, and right. There's this huge storehouse of stem cells in the bone marrow, causes it to go into hyperdrive to restock the blood, and the blood comes out through the bones and, you know, into the bloodstream, but that a fair number of stem cells get blown out at the same time and get into the bloodstream and become, you know, reparative cells so that the heart tissue that got damaged gets repaired and the pancreas tissue that gets damaged and whatever it may be, and that might account for why when women stop menstruating, their risk of heart attack becomes equal to that of men, whereas up until that time, it's a quarter lower, and among other things, all these other things. Any thoughts on that based on your experience with stem cells?
I would say that certainly sounds like a totally logical and reasonable possibility. I also wanted to point out that at the University of Toledo, they have done these injections with the same type of bone marrow stem cells into knees, the people that needed certain types of reasons for knee replacements,
yeah,
and it regenerated the cartilage, and they didn't have to have regular knee replacements. Now, they're still doing that, and it's still in a clinical trial, but it's been working, and I know of a couple of people that have had that, and within a month or 6 weeks, they're walking on it, and it's, you know.
Well, I can tell you just, you know, my personal experience, and again, this is subject to a huge chunk of confirmation bias or placebo effect. But when I read that study, it was a little over a decade ago, I started, you know, dropping a pint of blood at least twice a year. Because I thought, okay, let's see what happens. And when I give blood, when my body loses a pint of blood, I feel so good for the next month or two. I feel like I just lost 5 years. I mean, I feel younger. And I don't know I don't know why that is. I mean, for men in particular, it's supposed to reduce the iron load in the liver, and so that's supposed to be a good thing. But it's just, anyhow, stem cells are fascinating. Paul, thanks for sharing your story with us.
If anybody wants to look it up, just Google M as in doctor, MD stem cells, and there's a whole bunch of articles and reference material about it.
Cool. Okay. Thank you, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening on WHMP's website. David in Auburn, Washington, listening to KBCS. Hey, David, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I called today to join the voices advocating for the children on the border. I know that there was rumor of compassionate conservatives in the 90s. I wonder where they are right now.
I think the only one out there is Glenn Beck.
Well, Ellis Island was originally where people came in. Well, these children, their coyotes come across on the land. Well, the earlier coyotes used ships. I can be George Bush with 1,000 points of light. There's 50,000 points of light on that border. Those children do grow up, and what we leave in their memory is going to hold with them through their whole lives.
Yeah.
My solution to it is either to establish a town on the border south of the Rio Grande annex it, use eminent domain, whatever they have to do, because they're talking about shipping them. Joint Base Lewis-McChord is one of the locations they're talking about. And the mayor in Lakewood is sniveling about, well, who's going to be responsible without them? Well, those children, they put a cost on everything, the conservatives, I should say, but they don't put a value on what those kids could bring in the future, because they are the future.
Yeah, they are. And these kids are telling horrible stories. You had this guy from Telemundo, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting his name right at the moment, who has a new show on MSNBC in the morning at 10 o'clock Eastern time. And he was interviewing a young woman, a teenage girl, who had escaped from one of those countries. I think it was Guatemala. And she was talking about the horrors she had seen, you know, and it's like these children have been raped. They've had people around them murdered. They've seen dead bodies. The death squads have come. They've had family members killed. It is mind-boggling what these children have gone through. And then, like, your word sniveling, I think, is perfect for the Americans who stand in front of the buses. The Americans who are all they're all white people. They're all the children of immigrants themselves, and they stand in front of the buses going, no, you can't come into my country. You know, Sitting Bull would have something to say to them. But David, thank you for your call, and well said, very well said. Gene in Detroit. Hey, Gene, what's up? You want to talk about the right to die?
Oh, hey, I was going to tell you a little story. When I was 10, my mom was diagnosed with cancer and went into the hospital in December. And they opened her up, and because she had a tumor the size of a football.
Wow.
That they took out. But they found out that she had colorectal and uterine cancer both. So when they opened her up, of course, back then, the cancer spread.
Right.
And anyway, they let her out of the hospital just before Christmas to spend with me. And I think it was something like once a week she had to go into the hospital and get what they called cobalt treatments.
Right, I remember.
Which killed not only the good cells, but the bad cells.
Right. Gene, we just have a half a minute left.
Anyway, so she ended up in a great deal of pain and ended up having to commit suicide after I went to school one day.
Oh, my.
And I had, in the last few years, taken a dog to be put down, and it was amazing how peacefully that dog went. But yet I had to watch and see my mother have to struggle with knowing that she was leaving me orphaned.
Right. Oh, Gene, thank you for sharing that story.
I also wanted to tell you that on Friday.
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
The 18th, the National Nurses United is coming to Detroit for a march and rally.
Oh, that's great. We'll have to get them on the air. Gene, thanks for the heads up. And people can just Google National Nurses United for more information. Thank you, Gene.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, I'll bet that has some tie-in to Netroots Nation. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nelson watching Free Speech TV in Remmer, Tennessee. Hey, Nelson, what's on your mind today?
I'm Tom. Called to talk about marijuana. You talked about it last week.
Mm-hmm.
I used to smoke marijuana for pain relief.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a bad accident. I've had 6 separate back operations. It worked well for me. My physician made a deal with me and talked me into quitting and letting him prescribe me a Schedule 2 narcotic. It helps, but it doesn't work as well as the cannabis did.
So have you gone back to the cannabis?
No.
Why not?
Tennessee is one of 3 states that has a drug monitoring law.
Right.
That every so often, if you're taking a Schedule II narcotic, they do a blood test and see what all is in your blood system.
Uh-oh.
And to make sure you're taking your drugs where you're supposed to, and see if you're having any illegal substance in them. And I could be, instance, kicked out of my doctor's office, and I'm not sure, but it could hurt my insurance coverage.
I'm not sure about that. That's insane, Nelson. Not to mention, you know, you could probably go to jail. Our pot laws in this country are just plain old, flat out insane. There's no other way to describe it. Nelson, thank you for sharing your story with us, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Carol in Twin Lake, Michigan. Hey, Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Yes, hello, Mr. Hartman. I just called in. It makes me wonder sometimes what these people are thinking of. We had a civil war in this country, and I don't know the exact number. I'm sure you do of people that were killed.
600,000, roughly.
Yeah. Yeah.
If my memory is correct. It was the bloodiest war in terms of, you know, relative to the size of our population that we've ever had.
Right. And now here we are, and we would have been just incensed if other countries had interfered with our civil war. And here we are over there, out of our nose in how many different civil wars.
Yeah.
And not nearly that many people have been killed in them, maybe in Syria, but... I just wonder what in the world we're doing.
It's the folly of empire, Carol. We got this idea back in the after World War II that, you know, hey, we kicked Hitler's butt and we took out Tojo. We are now the world's empire, the world's superpower.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union got the same idea. And between the two of us, we kind of locked down the world. And, you know, and the point of conflicts between the two of us, the major point of conflict between the two of us was Vietnam. The secondary one was Cuba. And we became a colonial power, and we used our for-profit companies like the United Fruit Company, which took over Nicaragua and Honduras and, you know, had already taken over a large chunk of Hawaii. Hawaii then became a state in the 50s. But this is the folly of empire. We thought that we are so big, we can rule the world. We know what's best. We're the smart guys just because we happen to have the strongest military. And we aren't the smartest guys. Nobody is the smartest guys. And people should be able to sort these things out for themselves. I'm with you, Carol. Thank you for the call. Thank you for pointing out. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is interesting. Pat Buchanan, who started working for Nixon in 1966, and he says, I don't see a single Republican candidate who could beat Hillary. Very, very interesting. Robert in Mesa, Arizona, you wanted to say something about about immigrants?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. First of all, I want to say I've listened to you a lot, and I really respect all your opinions, and I've learned a lot from you. But I have a question about the immigration thing, the way that, you know, the standard of living for American citizens that are here, whatever race you are, wherever you're from, we're all from other countries. Of course, we're all immigrants, like you said.
But, except the Native Americans.
You know, as it's bringing down our standard of living and our wages, and you know, they're definitely, you know, affecting the wage thing, or the corporate America wouldn't be wanting to bring them all in, so, you know, and give them all, you know, visas and everything. Where does it end? I mean, do we just bring in everybody in the whole world until we're just like another third world nation, or... I think
that's the question,
not,
Robert.
It's an economic thing. I mean,
Robert, I think this is the question that a lot of conservatives are asking, and then Pat Buchanan would add to that, and what happens when white people become a minority in this Anglo-Saxon culture that is the superior culture on the planet is overwhelmed by Latino culture or black culture or whatever, which is a racist argument, and very often the economic argument that you're making has a racist argument underneath it, although I'm assuming that you're not trying to make that argument. But here's the there's a very simple answer. Robert, if we were to, number one, stop so-called free trade policies that send our jobs overseas, that's what's whacked the middle class, you know, for the last 30 years. Reagan started this. Well, arguably Nixon started it with his, quote, opening to China. Let's have free trade. But Reagan really put it on steroids. And then Bill Clinton, you know, pumped it into the stratosphere with NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO. And now you've got a kind of bipartisan consensus that the Shafta should come along next. If we brought our jobs back home, even with 11 million immigrants in this country, we could bring unemployment to zero and we could raise the standard of living very, very, very quickly. We used to have mills in this country. We used to make things in this country, number one. So it's not, you know, immigration in and of itself is not a problem. Number two, we don't have a problem with illegal immigrants. We have a problem with illegal employers. Before 86, when Reagan, quote, reformed the immigration laws and stopped enforcing he started selectively enforcing them. In 83, he was selectively enforcing the antitrust laws so that corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger, which has wiped out all the downtowns and all the unique character of small towns all across the United States. They're all replaced by chain stores and Olive Gardens and Walmarts. And because he stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 83. In 86, he stopped enforcing the prosecution of employers who hired people who were here without proper documentation. And as a consequence, the meatpacking industry, the construction industry, and a whole lot of other industries that used to be good union $40 or $50 an hour job equivalents in today's dollars, you know, became poverty wages because these employers were saying, hey, you know, I'll hire anybody and I won't go to jail. So you've got a problem with basically white rich employers not being prosecuted for immigration violation. That's the magnet that drew people here. That's a completely different thing, however, from these 50,000 kids on our border who are there in large part as a consequence of the policies of Ronald Reagan. I mean, you go back to the 80s, in the 1980s during the Reagan administration, from 500,000 to 1 million, I'm reading from Presidential Body Count, a new book by Al Carroll, from 500,000 to 1 million Salvadoran refugees fled to the United States, 500,000 to 750,000 more to Mexico, one-fifth of the Salvadoran population was displaced, 15% of all Guatemalans fled their nation, 1.5 million people. Genocide in Guatemala was so extreme that it was the only nation anywhere in Latin America to actually decline in population. These were called the Mayan Wars of the 1980s. This is what Ronald Reagan was supporting illegally with Ollie North taking money from or selling weapons to Iran illegally and taking it down to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. 626 Indian villages were massacred. Over 85% of the victims killed in the Civil War were slaughtered by the Guatemalan army, 10% by the death squads. Reagan holds the ugly distinction of causing the deaths of more Native people than any other president in American history. The Guatemalan army carried out scorched earth tactics with Ollie North's money, starving Mayan Indians out, burying villages, carrying out deaths by beheading, hacking to death, burning alive, or burying alive. An especially vicious tactic was bashing in the heads of small children on rocks, usually in front of their parents. Mass rapes were epidemic, including targeting pregnant women with multiple rapes to cause miscarriages. Perhaps the ugliest aspect of the genocide was ordering Mayan Indians to kill other Mayan Indians. Mayan men were ordered to attack other Mayans or their families would be massacred by government troops. That happened a generation ago. And now the children of that generation, the children who were the witnesses to that, many of them having become basically sociopaths as a consequence of that kind of childhood, are inflicting that on another generation. And those people are fleeing. And you've got these kids showing up at the border, literally children showing up at the border saying, they killed my entire family. They killed my parents. They killed my older brother or older sister. And I'm the only one left. And what are we supposed to do with them, Robert?
You know, I want to be humane to the whole process. It's not that it has anything against these people, but I just don't know
where
it ends. I mean,
where it ends is we get together with other southern and Central American countries and with Mexico and say we have a humanitarian crisis in these three countries, which is the result of Reagan era policies, and we need to fix that. We need to do something about that. And in the meantime, we need to be taking these are refugees. These are not immigrants. We need to be taking refugees. Robert, thank you for the call. This is, you know, and in fact, you know, Guatemala has a national health care system. There was a time when they actually had a functioning democratic government. And so the kids showing up on our border are more likely to be immunized than our Texan kids. One in five Texan kids have no health insurance whatsoever. All Guatemalan kids do. We'll be back with more tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.